I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
If a family and their physician are comfortable administering treatment, why on earth does the state need to be involved?
Another round of bills focused on trans kids is moving through the Capitol.
Also this week, lawmakers are looking to codify the definition of anti-Semitism.
There is an ongoing campaign, a misinformation campaign, to say that this violates free speech. It does not.
Plus, lawmakers are proposing their solutions to Georgia's housing challenges.
If you can never have a chance or an opportunity to get a piece of land, a house to call your own, a deck to have a barbecue on the back of, then the American dream is nothing but an American nightmare.
And later, we'll go deep on investors gobbling up thousands of single-family homes in Atlanta. We'll be joined by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's Brian Eason. I'm Raul Bally, politics reporter for WABE.
And I'm WABE politics reporter Sam Greenglass. It's week 8 of the Georgia General Assembly.
And this is Gold Dome Scramble, a pop-up podcast from Political Breakfast and WABE News in Atlanta.
Let's start with Buckhead Cityhood, Raul. We have been here before. We have talked on this podcast how bills to move ahead with the cityhood movement probably are not going anywhere. But why do you think we should be paying attention to what unfolded related to Buckhead Cityhood this week?
So, Sam, we've had two major hearings in the state Senate committee that's considering the bills. And there was just this interesting dynamic that the majority of opponents showed up to one hearing while the vast majority of supporters showed up to the other hearing. And supporters are playing, you know, two basic arguments. Allow us to vote because you've allowed others to have a vote on cityhood, and that crime is a problem in Buckhead.
Okay, pick up on both of those two things. Can you give us a little more context on each of those arguments?
So look, crime is an issue across the state. And I hear that when I talk to law enforcement, when I talk to prosecutors. And look, it's clear that the Buckhead Cityhood folks are saying that crime issues are worse for them than others. The other important piece of context, and I think this is much more important when it comes to Buckhead Cityhood, all the other cityhood movements, Sandy Springs, East Cobb, Mableton, the ones that have gone through and the ones that have failed, were all cities being created from unincorporated counties. Buckhead City is being created out of an existing city that brings a number of legal issues, financial issues. It brings up the issues of what happens around Atlanta Public Schools. Look, the chairman of the Senate committee considering Buckhead Cityhood tells me that he plans on a vote on Monday. So we're going to see some sort of movement in the coming week. Staying on the issue of hearings, like those two Buckhead hearings, the most interesting thing is the public comment portion to me. You get insight, you get emotion, you get passion. And in the same way that I saw that in the Buckhead hearings, Sam, you were seeing that happen in some hearings you were watching around the issue of healthcare for transgender kids. Sam, take us to those hearings.
So lawmakers are hearing two bills that deal with care for trans kids. SB 140 would ban gender-affirming surgery and hormone replacement therapy for minors. SB 141 would do those things, but it would also ban puberty blockers, which delay puberty. Now, some medical researchers say more research is still needed to fully understand the outcomes of prescribing these drugs to adolescents, But right now, the American Academy of Pediatrics, for example, their guidance recommends that doctors do provide children with, quote, comprehensive, gender-affirming, and developmentally appropriate healthcare. Just one other little bit of data to put on this, a 2021 study by the Trevor Project, they found that trans youth who received hormone therapy had lower rates of depression, lower rates of suicide attempts than those who did not.
Sam, this is not the first year that you have been covering legislation at the state capitol around transgender kids. Can you maybe kind of step away and give us more context about these bills, about this type of legislation?
So before we even go back to last session, this session, lawmakers are also considering a bill that would prevent teachers, coaches, camp counselors, other adults like that from talking about sexual orientation and gender identity with kids. Last year, lawmakers passed a bill paving the way for a ban on trans kids playing on the school sports team that matches their gender identity. And a recent NPR analysis found that state lawmakers across the country introduced at least 306 bills targeting trans people just in the last 2 years. That's more than any previous two-year period. 86% of those bills were focused on trans youth specifically.
So there's a lot going on at the state capitol. I do want to change gears and talk about, you know, a conversation at the Gold Dome, and that's around the news around former President Jimmy Carter entering hospice care. Most everybody at the state capitol has some sort of cool story connected to the former president, even dating back to when he was a governor or even a state senator. I ran into Democratic Congressman Sanford Bishop, who was visiting the state capitol. His relation dates back decades, including when then-Governor Jimmy Carter appointed Bishop to a commission in 1972. That's 51 years ago. Like Bishop, there are so many people at the state capitol who have different relationships with the Carter family, and we're thinking about all of them.
And I just want to chime in real quickly to say that outside of the state capitol too, you know, I spent some time on the grounds of the Carter Center on President's Day, you know, this beautiful day as everything was starting to be in bloom, and lots of people were just strolling around taking a few moments to reflect about Carter's impact on the state and on the country. And I think that's what we're going to continue to see over these next days and weeks. Raul, you mentioned there that you ran into Congressman Sanford Bishop at the Capitol this week. Can I just tell you real quick about someone that I ran into at the Capitol this week? Speaking of surprise Capitol run-ins.
Sure.
So I was covering a press conference at the Capitol steps about anti-Semitism. And the first speaker to get up on the stage gets up, introduces herself, says, "My name is Peggy Shapiro." And she said that she was born in the refugee camp in Landsberg, Germany, after World War II. And the reason this struck a chord for me is that is the same refugee camp where my grandparents met after World War II, and where my aunt was born probably, you know, within a year of this woman who was speaking under the Gold Dome. So to me, that was just this cool moment of you never know who you're going to find under the Gold Dome and all the different cross sections of life that come through the People's House here in Georgia.
I love that story. I really do. I feel like that happens at the state capitol every so often, you know, over through my years in the state capitol. Someone will say, somebody's from somewhere, or you know somebody. And it really, for me, causes me to stop and really appreciate what we get to do at the state capitol. Because I feel like the state capitol is one of the few places stories like that, your story even happens. I do want to stay on that press conference because House Bill 30 has been an interesting piece of legislation. It deals with anti-Semitism, and it's a bill that's had a pretty bumpy road, Sam.
So let me just run down real quick what this bill would do. The legislation would formally define anti-Semitism in state law, and it would compel the state to use that definition when evaluating violations of anti-discrimination laws or when weighing hate crime charges. Now, you mentioned some pushback, and a lot of this centers around free speech concerns. This often comes up in the context of hate crimes bills specifically. The sponsors, as we heard up in the top there from State Representative Esther Panich, note that these enhanced penalties, they don't come into play unless a crime was already committed. And I think all of this is interesting too in this moment because it dovetails with the debate that we saw over Georgia's hate crimes bill, which was signed 3 years ago after the murder of Ahmaud Arbery. That hate crimes bill does include religion, but sponsors say that it is difficult to prosecute those crimes in practice without a working definition of anti-Semitism in state law, and that is what this bill tries to do.
I do want to update one other topic that we've been talking about here on the podcast before we hit our break, and that's around the issues of affordable housing and investor-owned housing. And we've been talking about some bills that were going to be filed. Well, those bills have been filed. I do want to mention those real quick. First, on the issue of affordable housing, on allowing what local governments can and cannot regulate. Those are House Bills 514 and 517 from State Representative Dale Washburn, who you've heard on WABE. And he basically is saying that local governments cannot, for example, limit square footage or mandate garages or ban vinyl siding, things that would make housing more affordable versus the idea of higher home values that some local governments may want. And then this interesting idea on investor-owned homes and taking away the state tax deduction on depreciation that is used by these corporations on the homes that they buy. And that's going to be House Bill 490, which was also just filed. Those bills do have some really hard paths, but these are some of the key legislation that comes up around housing.
Let's take a break here. When we come back, we're going to talk about housing, specifically how investors, as Raul just mentioned, are gobbling up thousands of single-family homes in Metro Atlanta. This is Gold Dome Scramble, a pop-up podcast from Political Breakfast and WABE.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at GeorgiaHealthInitiative.org.
Welcome back to Gold Dome Scramble. Our guest this week is Brian Eason. He's a government reporter with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and is part of the latest investigation called American Dream for Rent. Hey, Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. I'm excited to be here.
So, Brian, you took a deep dive into this trend of investment companies buying up thousands of single-family homes in Metro Atlanta and also in other Sunbelt cities around the country, and then putting them up for rent. Just to start off here, can you give us a little bit of a sense of the scale of what's going on here?
Yeah, so, you know, and this all started kind of in the wake of the Great Recession, but we've really seen it pick up in the last few years, particularly during the pandemic. But at this point in Metro Atlanta, we were able to identify 65,000 homes that are owned by what we're calling large investors. And we set the threshold at anyone that has 50 or more houses, right? Like if you're buying 50 houses, you're probably not, you know, your little mom and pop landlord or your friend who has a couple investment properties, right? And some of these companies, you know, they own 1,000 or more. We found, I think 10 or so that had over 1,000, and a couple of them, the two largest, have over 10,000 homes in the 11-county area.
So it's time for my favorite segment, Story Time with Raul. And seriously, it's when my wife and I were still a military family, we were shipped out of Fort Gordon near Augusta in 2014, and we were able to sell our house very quickly. It was actually sight unseen. And it wasn't until we got to the closing table that we realized our house was being bought by one of these companies. And they turned around and rented the home. And I couldn't help myself. I went back and looked, and they were renting it out for like $100 to $150 a month more than our mortgage was. So my question to you, Brian, is why did this start happening in the first place?
You know, I hate to like give history lessons every time I talk about this, but a lot of it really does go back to the Great Recession, right? We had so many homes in foreclosure. The federal government, all the financial institutions were really reeling in the aftermath of this. And federal policymakers were looking around going, well, what can we do? We have to stabilize the economy. We have to stabilize the housing market. And one thing they settled on was, okay, we need to find large groups that have a lot of money that can buy a lot of homes off our hands at once. And that group was private equity. They launched this pilot program to sell foreclosed homes in bulk. That pilot program actually didn't take off in Atlanta. Nonetheless, that really kind of sparked this industry, which has now become a pretty large force nationally. Even though that pilot program didn't really work out here, Atlanta has become one of, if not the hottest markets for this industry. And so what these companies will do is they'll buy up a lot of single family homes and they'll rent them out.
So when you've got all of these investors who are swooping in, buying up these houses instead of regular people, what does that do to the price of houses overall for your regular family, young couple, whatever, who's looking to buy a home at an affordable price?
Our data team was able to do kind of a deep analysis of this. And what they found was that in the 30 zip codes that had the most investor activity, prices were rising nearly twice as fast as the 30 zip codes that didn't have a lot of investor activity.
And, you know, you mentioned these zip codes where a lot of this is happening. You worked with a data reporter to map out where a lot of these investor-owned homes are located. When you look at the neighborhoods, what did you see when you kind of take a look at that map that you've created?
So disproportionately, these firms are buying in majority Black areas. I don't want people to think that this is only happening in Black neighborhoods, right? When we mapped it, it forms basically a giant circle around Metro Atlanta. But it is more prevalent in kind of the southern, more racially diverse suburbs. And the reasons for that it does date back to the housing crisis, right? Why would Black neighborhoods be disproportionately targeted? Well, Black home buyers were disproportionately being sold predatory loans leading up to the Great Recession. So a lot of these communities were very heavily hit by the housing crisis. Those same communities now are really being hit by these investors. And I think there's one other reason, and that is that, you know, investors, they want a good deal, right? Like, so they're looking at places where homes are going to be more affordable. And we know from study after study that African-American-owned homes are undervalued relative to what they should be. There is bias in the appraisal process in the United States.
So I want to slightly shift this conversation. You know, we've been talking about home ownership. And with all the challenges around home ownership, you're seeing the path for housing for a lot of people is through renting. Georgia has some of the weakest laws when it comes to tenant protections. Right now, there's a bipartisan bill in the Georgia legislature backed by the House Speaker that's going to tighten up a few things when it comes to these issues around tenant protections. Brian, I want to hear from you. What have you heard from people who are renting, and specifically people who are renting from these corporations?
I would say there's kind of two big buckets of complaints that I hear a lot. One of them is just the inability to get an absentee landlord to make repairs when something's wrong with your home. You know, we talked to a number of renters who had to put in work order after work order after work order and can't get anyone on the phone. And there was one woman who her air conditioning was out all summer. And so she had to move herself and her daughter out to a hotel. At no point would the landlord fix it. She went to the city, code enforcement said, yep, there are two violations. The landlord didn't fix this woman's air conditioning, which went out kind of in the late spring, early summer, until the second week of August. In the meantime, this woman is forced to continue paying rent. Otherwise, she'll get evicted. She had to pay out of pocket for a hotel so that she had somewhere to live. And at the end of the day, this company, the only financial difficulty it faced from the city that was trying to hold them accountable was a couple of $250 fines. The consequences for renters that face maintenance problems don't stop there either. So this woman, she, under Georgia law, you can do what's known as repair and deduct. So she files a claim and says, look, I can't get my landlord to fix this. I'm going to install my own air conditioning. I'm going to pay for it. I'm going to deduct that from my rent. As soon as she filed that, the company tried to evict her. So this woman who is stuck continuing to pay money to a landlord that won't fix her air conditioning is now facing an eviction filing, and we know what that can do to somebody's credit. And one thing I do want to make clear is that this is not an isolated incident. We heard this so many times from renter after renter. They run into problems with maintenance, their landlord won't fix it, and either because the renter tried to take matters into their own hands, or because in a lot of cases the renter just ran out of money to deal with the situation, they'll end up with an eviction filing against them for a situation that didn't start out as their fault.
So let me follow up with that bill. It's House Bill 404. And one of the interesting discussion points that's going to be in that bill are rules around livability, as you were talking about, Brian. And so it's going to be interesting to be able to connect those stories that you're talking about with what will happen with House Bill 404 as it starts moving through the legislature.
Yeah, definitely. And I've heard from a number of housing advocates. There are things they do like about the bill around habitability. There's things that they don't like about the bill in terms of it making it maybe a little bit easier in some cases for landlords to evict people.
Brian, I want to go back to the title of your investigation, which is American Dream for Rent. Clearly, it sounds like something is broken here. I wonder what you think are the consequences if this trend goes unchecked with these investor-owned homes, and is there any political will to regulate or curtail this practice of investors eating up all of these single-family homes here in Atlanta?
That's a really important question, because I think that the long-term implications are really troubling in a lot of cases, right? We know that home ownership is the number one source of middle class wealth in America. It provides so much opportunity to families in terms of, you know, being able to develop a nest egg and save up for college for their kids, or just having financial stability throughout life and not having to worry about your rent going up or where you're going to live next, or are you going to have to yank your kid out of their school district, right? So if we are talking about a society where more and more of the homes that are being built are exclusively going to be rented out, I think that has real implications for just financial stability for the American middle class, right? The other implication I see long term is, and we're already starting to see it in some neighborhoods where investors have bought the most homes, is renters are really running out of choices. I talked to so many families who told me, yeah, I would love to move. I would love to not rent from this large out-of-state investor, but I can't find anything. People's choices are constrained by, number one, their budget, and number two, if you have kids, you can't easily look around for housing. You have to find something that's in your school district and fits your budget. And if large investors own such a large percentage of the houses that those are the only landlords you can find, that's really concerning given some of the reports we've heard from people about how they're being treated. You asked a second question, which was about the political will to do anything about the investor side. It really gets at some difficult questions, philosophical questions in our society, which deal with property rights and capitalism and who should be allowed to own what. And number one, I don't see a lot of clear-cut solutions from people who are critical of this trend. And number two, I still think there is some skepticism from Republicans who may support stronger habitability protections, but aren't necessarily singling out investors as the bad guy, right?
Brian Eason of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, thank you so much for joining us. Hey, folks, if you want to read this amazing piece of journalism, you can go to ajc.com/American Dream. The AJC has put this in front of their paywall. So this is some great journalism, great data reporting that you can go read. Brian, thanks again so much for joining us.
Really appreciate you guys having me. This is a really important topic.
Gold Dome Scramble is a production of the WABE Politics team. Our producer is Kevin Rinker. Our managing editor is Alex Helmick. You can get more Georgia politics on our sibling podcast, Political Breakfast with Lisa Raham. It's out every Wednesday.
You can also head to a special page on our website for all things Georgia politics, wabe.org/underthegolddome. We'll be back next week.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of mysteries. Are ghosts real? Is that yogurt expired? Hey, the unknown can be scary, but when you donate to WABE, you know where your money is going. Your gift supports the journalism that keeps you informed and the programs that pull back the curtain on complicated stories. Help us make the world less mysterious. Become a member now. Go online to wabe.org/donate, and thanks.